WFAE Podcasting is funded by Corporate Information Technologies, helping businesses take a proactive approach to technology. CIT, let us show you how good IT can be. corp-infotech.com.
HealHomeShow.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. During the last presidential campaign, Sarah Palin was heard on a number of occasions to utter the phrase, "Drill, baby, drill." She, along with many others, see drilling for oil and gas as the solution to our energy and natural gas problems, the path to energy independence. It is true that there are vast supplies of oil and natural gas beneath North America, but it has been very difficult to get to much of it in the last several years. The birth of new technologies, however, makes access easier and profitable. But some believe that the potential cost of the environment is a price that is too high to pay. They see our energy future as one dependent on clean technologies like wind, solar, and geothermal. Jack Girard is president and CEO of the American Petroleum Institute. He has also served in the same capacity with the American Chemistry Council and the National Mining Association. As you might imagine, he doesn't fall into the alternative energy sources camp. He believes that increased domestic production will create much-needed jobs, bolster the economy, and lessen our dependence on foreign oil. Mr. Girard believes those factors combined with new technologies are the perfect storm of opportunity and one that we should pursue. And Jack Girard joins us by phone for the hour to make his case. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be part of your program.
I should mention that Mr. Girard will be here in town on Thursday of next week, the 23rd of August, at noon to speak at the World Affairs Council Charlotte lunch at the Hilton Charlotte Center City, and we'll put information about that and how you can attend on our website at WFAE.org. I've spoken over the years, Mr. Girard, to several people in the oil and gas industry, as well as those who could be described as being proponents of alternative energy strategies, and almost all of them, to a person, say that this country does not have, but desperately needs, an energy policy. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think you've hit it right on the head, Mike, in this process. And let me just clarify one thing you said earlier, which I think really makes this point even better. Today, the United States really doesn't have a comprehensive energy policy. And many people probably don't appreciate or understand, but the oil and natural gas industry in the United States are the leaders in alternative and renewable forms of energy. Since 2000, the federal government has spent about $43 billion trying to find these new alternative clean forms of energy. And we in the oil and gas industry have invested $71 billion, almost twice what the federal government has invested. Our number, $71 billion, is almost equal to the $74 billion invested by everybody else. So when you look at energy policy in the United States, we are true proponents of all the above. We think you need oil and natural gas. You need solar, you need wind, you need nuclear, you need renewable fuels. You need everything that we're talking about today because the demand for energy as our population grows and our economy expands is only going to increase. So when we look at the various forms of energy, we need to focus on each and every one of them. The one caveat I would add, however, is we also need to stay focused on those energies which matter most to us right now. And today, 62% of all the energy we consume in the U.S. is oil and natural gas. And the Obama administration's Department of Energy will tell you that 30 years from now, 55 to 57% of all the energy we consume in the United States will still be oil and natural gas. So while we're developing all the above in a true sense, we need to also focus and remember that the clear majority of that energy is still oil and natural gas. So we should do everything we can to produce it right here in the United States, employing Americans, producing American energy by Americans for Americans. So that's our fundamental message. While the president talks about all the above, he clearly does not support production of all the above. He's focused on just a few energy types and focus mainly on solar and wind, And we believe that is an important part, but it's a very small part of that broader policy. So, yes, we don't have an energy policy today.
Okay, I have to ask. I know if I were talking to the head of ExxonMobil or the head of BP or Shell, they would probably say exactly what you just said, and they would have skin in the game because they are an energy. They are energy companies, not just oil and
Absolutely.
Gas companies. And so they would say that they might have less of a protectionist attitude toward oil and gas and be more open to investing in and developing alternative energy sources. But you are the president and CEO of the American Petroleum Institute, and your best interest is to keep the oil flowing. Am I wrong?
Well, I think there's a combination there, Mike. Remember, when you look at the American Petroleum Institute, our primary focus is oil and natural gas. But the people who sit around my board are the chairman of ExxonMobil, the chairman of Chevron, the chairman of BP, Shell, the list goes on. So I represent all their interests. Our primary focus is oil and natural gas, but we do a lot of work in the area of wind, of solar, of renewables. We have a department in our organization we call Downstream, which is focused on the refining sector. And that deals a lot with renewable fuels because that's become a big part of that space. So we do a little of all of it, but you're right. Our primary focus is oil and natural gas.
You worked for a while with former U.S. Senator from Idaho, James McClure, who chaired the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee back in the 80s, I believe. Was the need for an energy policy apparent back then? And if so, why hasn't it happened yet?
Well, Mike, that's a great question, and Senator McClure, and I might be a little biased, but he was a great leader in this area. Unfortunately, he passed almost a year ago now after a great career in public service. He articulated, even in the mid-70s, during the Arab oil embargo and some of the challenges we faced 40 years ago, he articulated the need for a broad energy policy that was clearly all the above. Now, if you look at the Department of Energy, it was created in the Nixon administration under the push and effort to make us less dependent on outside sources for energy. So we've been at that for 30-plus years and really haven't made much progress. Where we've really made progress is over the past 3 or 4 years, and we've made progress in the United States because of our breakthrough in technologies and because of the vast oil and natural gas resources we have right here. Let me just give you a little case study. The great state of North Dakota. Now, most people think of that as a very small state, and it is from a population perspective. But today, they are the number 2 oil producer in the United States. In this year alone, they have surpassed Alaska and California to begin to rival what Texas produces in oil. And why is that? Because of our new technologies of horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing, we're now able to produce small quantities of oil and natural gas that were essentially in pockets in rock seams at, you know, anywhere from a mile or 2 miles down in the Earth's surface that were not economic before. So technological advancements have allowed us to move into areas and make the United States, as quoted by the Congressional Research Service, the most energy-rich nation in the world, bar none. We have in the state of Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado more oil than Saudi Arabia has. All we've got to do is have the political will to produce it. And that's why we take such strong exception to some of the administration's policies. The president talks about being for all the above, but just yesterday they locked up half of the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska that was set aside since the 1930s to be used for oil and gas production. And yesterday, Secretary Salazar of Interior made an announcement trying to suggest, well, we're going to go produce a little oil and gas here, but the real announcement was we're going to lock up half of that reserve that was already designated by law to be used for oil and gas production. And that's what's wrong with our energy policy, is we really don't have one. And so it's being made hit and miss, depending upon whose favorite friends you have when you happen to be in positions of power like the Secretary of Interior.
And their reasoning for this was what?
Well, it's interesting. They've gone up there and they've tried to convince the American people that they're for oil and natural gas. But all you have to do is look behind the curtain and realize that all the actions that are being taken by the administration are to restrict or discourage oil and gas development in the United States. So while they talk about, you know, oil being production being up in this country is higher than it's ever been in the past 8 years, that's true. What they don't tell you is that is all coming off private and state land. The area where they have control on federal land, production is down in the Gulf of Mexico over 22% from where it was supposed to be at this time. Leasing and permitting in the western Rocky Mountain states on federal land where the president has control is down over 44% since they took office. And again, just yesterday, in a vast area of Alaska, which was set aside by law to produce oil and natural gas, they took one half of it offline yesterday and said, we'll never produce in these areas. So when you compare the actions versus the rhetoric, this administration has done much to discourage the development of America's oil and natural gas, yet when you hear them on the campaign stump, you'd believe that they were actually for it. But their actions speak louder than their words, and the public understands that. The public overwhelmingly supports development of our own resource. Unfortunately, we need political leaders to exercise a little leadership, step forward, and make this resource available for the benefit of all Americans.
You're calling for the opening of the Eastern Gulf of Mexico, the Atlantic Outer Continental Shelf, and the Pacific Outer Continental Shelf for drilling. How badly did the BP oil spill in the Gulf set back your cause and your industry and your desire to have these publicly held lands and also these outer shelf areas opened for oil and gas drilling?
Well, Mike, that is a great question, but I think there's two responses to that. And the first one is, in the eyes of this administration, they have repeatedly used that as an excuse to not open up further lands for oil and gas development. But I'll tell you, in a poll that we just conducted over the weekend with straight-up questions about do you support more offshore oil and gas development, over 70% of the American people believe we should have more offshore development. Yet the administration's policies have put off limits over 87% of the Outer Continental Shelf.
Let me ask you to defend the oil and gas industry and their offshore drilling practices. It seemed when we were watching the BP oil disaster unfold that nobody at BP was behind the wheel. Nobody really knew what to do. Some of the activities that had taken place, and this is, I know, only one company and not the whole industry, but some of the activities that had taken place behind the scenes leading up to that oil spill seemed to be almost negligence on the part of the company and not taking the advice of their own engineers. Why should we trust oil and gas in these areas that are relatively pristine and, if not pristine, could be destroyed by a major spill, the likes of which we just saw in the Gulf a few years ago?
Well, that's a great question, and let me respond to that in a couple different ways. Number one, I think we have to realize that there's risks involved with everything we do every day, particularly in terms of producing oil and natural gas. And the key for the oil and natural gas industry is to stay focused on that risk to make sure not only do we protect our people, but we protect the environment at the same time. The second part of it, I think, is to put it in context. We've been drilling in that part of the Gulf of Mexico for over 65 years. We drilled 42,000 wells before this event ever occurred. Now, that's not to justify this event, because it was highly inappropriate. It was clearly a tragedy. But the first thing the oil and natural gas industry did is we put together, under the auspices of the API, what we called our Joint Industry Task Force. We got the best minds in the industry together from all over the world. We quickly developed new best practices and standards
Let me interrupt. I'll let you follow up on that at the end of the break. We have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gaston Hospice, an affiliate of Caremont Health, serving the people of Gaston County and the surrounding area since 1981. On the web at gastonhospice.org. Well, when the DNC security plan was announced last week, showing a grid of closed-off streets and a host of restrictions, the reaction by some folks around town was, you can't get there from here. Police Chief Rodney Monroe countered that the plan would add only about 20 to 30 minutes to the average commute of anybody heading downtown. But if you look carefully at the plan, it raises a host of questions from those who live and work downtown, those with businesses there, and for those working with the convention, in fact. So we'll try to get some answers on what this may mean for you when the DNC arrives and the streets close tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, some climate change skeptics have reassessed their views. Shifts in the debate on the role of humans in a warming world.
You're invited to join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jack Girard is our guest today, President and CEO of the American Petroleum Institute. He will be in town to speak next Thursday at noon at the Hilton Charlotte Center City with the World Affairs Council Charlotte. Information about that is on our website at WFAE.org. I had to interrupt you prior to the break.
Not a problem,
a statement. Mike. So go ahead and finish what you were talking about. I'm sorry.
Well, Mike, what we were talking about is the need for enhanced and improved safety at all times in oil and gas development. And following the tragic spill in Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico, the industry quickly assembled the best minds in the world. We developed best practices, which is something the API has done for many years. We took those and shared them with the Department of Interior, our primary regulator. And one of the first things they did was adopt those best practices as part of their regulatory regime to enhance safety and performance not only to our people but to the environment clear across the board. And so we work very closely with the regulators. We believe we need a very robust regulator that's grounded in science and technology, that understands what it is we do in a very space-age way to produce the oil and gas that the country demands.
Let me ask you, because there are so many people who are suspicious of this and so many people who are really concerned, legitimately concerned about the environment and about what might happen in some of these pristine areas where we have not allowed drilling and where we want to allow it, or at least your industry wants to allow it, and about this Canadian pipeline that people are concerned about and its potential damage to the environment. If you were to get your way, because right now we get our gas and oil from Canada, we get our natural gas probably from the United States, we get it from Mexico, we get it from Saudi Arabia, and we're doing okay, although the prices have been known to creep up toward $5 a gallon, which doesn't make anybody happy. But if you in your industry got your way, if we opened up these areas that are off limits today, and you had no accidents whatsoever, and you pump the oil and you retrieve the natural gas, what would that mean to the average person?
Well, there's multiple answers to that. It's a wonderful question. What it would mean is we would become energy self-sufficient in the United States and Canada, right here in North America.
And what would that mean to me when I fill up my car?
That means that you wouldn't have to worry about the volatility coming out of the Middle East. You wouldn't have to worry about the Straits of Hormuz discussion, at least as it relates to energy production and import.
But isn't a lot of the price volatility attached not to the Middle East and threats we may hear from them, but about speculators who are trying to hedge their bets on Wall Street?
Well, when some people talk about speculators, markets are driven by expectations. If the marketplace knew, for example, that we were going to produce our own oil and natural gas right here in the United States and Canada combined, I'm confident, and history shows, that would put downward pressure on price. Let me give you one key example. Look at the price of natural gas today in the United States. When we've had the major breakthrough of hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling, natural gas price has dropped from $13 to a little over $2 today. That saves American consumers $500 million a day in their cost to heat and power their homes. That is a very significant benefit to all consumers. The other thing it's doing today, Mike, and a lot of people are talking about it, but they haven't fully made the connection. The reason we're seeing manufacturing come back to the United States, particularly in the Midwest, the old Rust Belt, it's because of the price of natural gas. when you think about chemical plants, you think about steel mills. I talked to the chairman of U.S. Steel. He just made a $100 million new investment in his steel plant in Lorain, Ohio, because of the resurgence of oil and natural gas right here in this country. We work closely with organized labor, with the building construction trades, the pipe fitters, the carpenters, and others, because we're providing those jobs. In the state of Pennsylvania in the last 18 months, we've created 83,000 new jobs by producing our own oil and natural gas, relying less on outside sources. Those jobs pay almost twice what the average worker in that state makes. So these are good jobs. It allows us to create jobs, pay our citizens well. It generates revenue to state and local governments, and it makes us more energy secure.
Help me understand.
That's a triple win. Please, Mike, go ahead.
Help me understand this. Both the Republicans and the Democrats, when they talk about energy independence, keep using the phrase, we need to reduce our reliance on foreign oil. And when Americans hear that phrase, they automatically think, yeah, Middle East, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, wherever else oil comes from in that part of the world, possibly Venezuela, where the leaders are not our biggest fans. But isn't it true that Canada is the number one supplier of imported oil to the United States? We produce half of what we need. Canada supplies 22%. 28% comes from other sources. And Mexico is number two to Canada. So when we're talking about foreign oil, we're really talking about Canada, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, in that order, aren't we?
Well, we are, but what the American people understand is our outside reliance beyond the bounds of North America. Most people really don't consider Canadian oil and natural gas to be foreign.
Of course not. Of course not, but when you say we need to reduce our reliance on foreign oil, what we're really saying is we need to reduce our reliance on oil from Saudi Arabia, and they come in at number three.
Yeah, but listen closely to what I'm saying. We can become energy self-sufficient right here in North America in less than 12 years. So working with our partners to the north, with Canada, because of the vast production they have and the opportunity they have to expand that production, right here in North America, a combination of an increase in our production in the United States, coupled with those imports, we could provide our own fuel right here in 12 short years. So we wouldn't have to rely on any other place around the world. We wouldn't have to worry about Venezuela. We wouldn't have to worry about Saudi Arabia. We wouldn't have to worry about Nigeria or elsewhere.
And yet, when any of us go to the gas station, we're getting oil. We have no idea where the gasoline comes from, except for the fact that it's branded by a sign. And usually the sign will say ExxonMobil, it will say BP, Shell, Chevron, you name it, it will say that.
Uh-huh.
These are all multinational companies, and they're buying energy from all kinds of nations around the world. Even if the United States can produce 100%, 110% of its energy needs, how do we know that the gasoline in the car, when we pump it out of the pump, is from the United States, Canada, or Mexico, as opposed to Saudi Arabia, or Venezuela, or Nigeria, or Russia, or Algeria, you name it. And if we can't control where these multinational companies buy their oil, what's the point?
Well, let me just test basic economic theory. If I can produce a barrel of oil in North Dakota, and I can refine that barrel of oil in Houston, why would I ship it offshore and bring somebody else's oil in for refinery if I could produce it right here for our domestic marketplace? We're the largest market in the world, and what will happen is just what we see happen on natural gas today. We are essentially providing all the natural gas that our economy needs, but we could provide even more if we could produce more right here on our own shores. Let's take a look at gasoline. We're able to produce, refine, and distribute enough gasoline here in the United States, supplemented by some imports from Europe to offset what gets exported, to satisfy our market. And now we've got an opportunity to export and improve our status in the balance of payments. We shouldn't overlook, we are the most energy-rich nation in the world. There was a great piece in the New York Times, well, it dates back about 4 or 5 months ago now, where it said because of our new technologies, our ability to produce our own energy right here on our own continent, we have the ability to change the geopolitical dynamic of the world. an economist for the World Affairs Forum, I believe, or the Council on Foreign Relations, about 2 months ago said, if we get our policies right in the United States, we will become the new Middle East for energy production. Now, that's a big deal. Now, the reason it's a big deal is look at where we are in the economy today. The first thing we need are jobs, and that's what the American public are talking about. Let's put our people to work producing our own energy for us and potentially for exports. The second item is revenue. At a time of record debt and deficit, the oil and natural gas industry contributes $86 million a day to the federal government, $86 million a day. We're the highest effective tax rate payers in the country, and yet the president continues to go out and criticize the industry as if we weren't doing our part. Not only are we doing our share, we're doing more than our fair share. But if we could produce more oil and natural gas right here in the U.S., we would generate more revenue to the federal state governments without any tax increases, taking pressures off individuals paying their individual taxes. And the third and last point to that is we become energy secure. We, working with our good friends in the North Canada, could dictate the energy future of our own nation. I can tell you the Chinese and others around the world whose economies are quickly expanding, they're going everywhere to identify, to buy up, and to secure their energy future with these oil and gas resources. We ought to do the same for ourselves so we no longer have to rely on volatile parts of the world. We know where our oil and gas can come from. It can come from right here in the good old USA, coupled with Canada, putting Americans to work, generating revenues for our state and local federal governments, and make us secure as a nation. Never before in my lifetime have we had such an opportunity. Now's the time. All we need are political leaders to act and to take the action necessary to make us the energy capital of the world.
And Canada is our number one, is the number one exporter of oil to the United States. We import most of our foreign oil from Canada. How does the oil we get from Canada compare to the amount of oil we are currently producing here in the continental United States and offshore?
Well, we produce more in the United States offshore and onshore than we get from Canada today.
Okay.
But we could expand our imports from Canada, particularly with the Keystone XL pipeline, which would create 20,000 new American jobs right here on our own soil. The Keystone Pipeline was also designed to take that production in North Dakota down to our refinery base in Houston in the Gulf Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that would bring Canadian oil here, but it also brings domestic oil in within our states from, you know, the upper Midwest down to the Gulf Coast.
We'll talk about the Keystone Pipeline because that's been controversial for years. I'm not sure why, because it's a pipeline. It's a pipe.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, if we produce in the United States more oil than we import from Canada, and Canada is the number one place that we get oil outside of our borders, how much of the oil that we produce domestically do we export? How much of it stays here versus how much do we export?
On a crude oil basis, it's very, very small. Probably less than 1% gets exported.
Mm-hmm. Why do we export any of it?
Well, you probably wouldn't, but for just pure economics. For example, if you've got a tanker of oil sitting off the coast in the Gulf of Mexico that's coming from Mexico or from, say, Venezuela,
mm-hmm.
it might be less costly to actually bring that on shore and refine it right there in Houston than put it in the pipeline and ship it to New York than it would be, for example, to try to get something from North Dakota, refine it in Chicago, and then pipe it all the way down to Houston, turn around, pipe it all the way back to New York. So there's some scales of economy and efficiencies that take place, but it's minimal. It's a small part. We shouldn't worry about those little nuances as much as focus on that bigger picture. How do we take the vast control of our own energy, produce it for our own people, and we can worry about those small exceptions? You hear a lot of our critics sometimes. They'll try to find the exception to the rule, make a big deal about it. We understand that. Most of them are just anti-production of oil and natural gas. So that's fine. That's their right to make that statement. But let's think about the heart and the soul of what we're really talking about. We're talking about literally changing the domestic economy and our infrastructure to support our people, creating jobs for our own people, providing our own energy. That is a big deal. It's a true game changer.
Jack Girard is president and CEO of the American Petroleum Institute. Let me share a couple of emails that have come in while we've been talking. Aaron writes, the U.S. peaked in oil production in 1971 and has seen a steady decline ever since. The world peaked in oil production in 2005. I'm not sure his numbers are accurate. Perhaps you can tell us. These simple facts seem to elude the understanding of most Americans, including your guest. Decades of exploration have not been able to reverse this trend. No amount of drill, baby, drill will ever get us back to anything like the amount of oil we produced in the 20th century. We will continue to produce less oil and natural gas going forward, and if we fail to manage this decline, we will suffer. We need to focus on moving away from fossil fuel energy.
Well, that's part of what we call the peak oil theory, and the peak oil theorists for many, many years have said we're running out of oil and natural gas. The resources in the world today are larger than they've ever been. They continue to grow. And we have a great piece. I think it might be on our website, api.org. And if it's not, I'm happy to send it to your guest who sent that, that goes back and recounts the history of the peak oil theorists. There were those when oil was first discovered in the United States thought we had 15 years or so availability. Subsequent to that, others have said, oh, it's going to be over by the 70s. And yet today, just like in the United States, our resource potential in this country has never been greater. Little old North Dakota just a few years ago was producing 60,000 barrels a day. Today that number has risen to over 640,000 barrels, and there's no end in sight to it. What they thought was a resource of a few million barrels of oil, today some experts estimate has over 24 billion barrels of oil in it. So we have never had an opportunity like today. So while I appreciate some of the naysayers and others who for many years have said, oh, we're running out, it's just that. They're naysayers. Our natural gas resource in the country due to our modern technologies, our breakthroughs over the past 3 or 4 years, now some people estimate we have over 200 years at current rates of consumption.
But, you know,
I believe that's conservative.
We have, I think it's relatively undeniable that we are experiencing some sort of climate change, whether it's a temporary or whether it's permanent, and whether fossil fuels have caused it or not, I suppose is a matter that's still up for some, but not a lot, of debate. So what isn't the encouragement of the development of other energy sources important? And isn't the encouragement of opening oil fields that have been closed to oil and gas drilling something that will slow down the development of the and the monies being devoted to the development of these alternate sources of fuel? Isn't it inevitable that at some point in the future we will need to cut the ties to fossil fuels, and shouldn't we be working toward that day? Wouldn't we be held back by enabling ourselves to continue?
Yeah, I guess it depends on your economic theory, Mike. There are those who believe that we ought to take gasoline to the price of $8 a gallon like in Europe, and somehow that's going to spawn other resources. We have a legal mandate to produce cellulosic ethanol in this country today. It's not been produced commercially. Why is that? Because the technology is not there to do it. So we need to be thoughtful. It took us 100 years in this country to get off wood as our primary form of energy. We are evolving to new energy forms, cleaner energy forms. That's good. That's what the oil and gas industry invests in. It's a great vision, but we've got to be realistic about what we do in the short term so we don't unintentionally impact adversely our consumers we're trying to move to new technology.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk about the Keystone Pipeline, among other things. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Magazine. The August issue features a guide to the city's Latin cuisine. Now on newsstands, details available at charlottemagazine.com. And by Heath Springs Residential Care Center, providing family-oriented long-term assisted living for the elderly in historic Heath Springs, South Carolina, for almost 20 years. Details at heathspringsrcc.com. Some climate change skeptics have reassessed their views. Diane Rehm and her guests discuss shifts in the debate on the role of humans in a warming world, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation with Jack Girard, who is the CEO and president of the American Petroleum Institute, 704-926-WFAE, 704-926-9323. 800-603-WFAE or online, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
This is Robert Siegel from NPR's afternoon news program, All Things Considered. All Things Considered is more than just headlines. We take the time to explore the why and how of the story, finding context and perspectives on the news that you simply don't hear elsewhere. We take the time to understand why a story is important and why it matters to you. All Things Considered from NPR News.
Catch All Things Considered, news you can trust, weekdays from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jack Girard is our guest. He's the president and CEO of the American Petroleum Institute. Mr. Girard will be in town next Thursday at noon to speak at the World Affairs Council Charlotte Luncheon at the Hilton Charlotte Center City. There are always seats available for that. We'll put information about that appearance on our website at WFAE.org. Let me share another email with you, Mr. Girard. Sarah in Charlotte actually Please. Couldn't hold, and so she asked us to pass this along. You can't talk about domestic production without considering environmental impact. So what about that? And I noticed yesterday in some source that I was reading from your organization, 25% of U.S. oil and natural gas production comes from offshore areas, and the American Petroleum Institute says that technology has enabled the industry to explore deeper waters in the Gulf of Mexico and to make many new discoveries while minimizing impact on the environment. I'm just curious, was that written before the BP oil spill?
It could be written both before and after.
Okay.
Because they're both true in the sense that while we get about 25, it was actually up a little bit. It was expected to be about 33% would be offshore. When the current administration imposed a moratorium in the Gulf of Mexico, what it did is it delayed and shut down a lot of that activity. And as you'll probably recall, many of those rigs left the Gulf and went elsewhere in the world. We're trying to get those back now. In fact, we're getting pretty close to having the same number of rigs in the Gulf of Mexico that we had prior to that spill. And the reason that's so important to us, each one of those rigs, combination of economic activity, employs thousands of people. It costs about $500,000 a day to operate one of those big drilling operations. So they can't sit idle. There's a lot of investment in them. They've got to keep them working. They've got to keep them going. But environmental protection is a top priority for the oil and natural gas industry. We have spent hundreds of thousands, millions, indeed billions of dollars in improving our technologies and our abilities. Let me give you one case in point around this area called hydraulic fracturing that you've probably heard about. And there's been some discussion on it in your good state down there, of course, in the state legislature. The impacts to water from hydraulic fracturing today, we have been using this technology for about 60 years. We have drilled over 1.2 million wells with it. And there has never been a case of groundwater contamination as a result of hydraulic fracturing. Never, not one. And yet, if you read some of the popular media and some of our critics, you'd think everything we do out there is destroying the environment and hurting the water table. And it's just not true.
Well, I was going to bring that up because when you read about fracking, some people believe it does everything from polluting the groundwater to releasing unnecessary quantities of methane into the atmosphere to causing earthquakes in some cases.
Yep.
Is any of that true?
Well, first of all, let's go back to the technology itself. Our critics talked about, and it's interesting, when you go read what our critics say, they will tell you that a lot of the discussion around things like hydraulic fracturing, around things like the Keystone XL pipeline, are actually surrogates to stop the production of oil and natural gas, and they're just quite bold about that. The Sierra Club has launched a new campaign called Off Natural Gas, or Beyond Natural Gas. We think that's beyond common sense. Natural gas is twice as clean as coal. Coal was 51% of our electricity generation in this country. Now we've got a cleaner version that's coming online and displacing the older fuels, and yet we have some of our critics who continue to insist we shouldn't use any of this energy. But when you add those energy components together, that's about 80% of the energy consumed in this country. So we need a robust public debate to talk about energy realities. And when the public understands those debates, and you got the public is smart. They get this stuff. They just have to take a little time from their daily activities and their focus trying to provide for their families to think about this for a while, and it becomes very clear very quickly. They get it, and they support the development of these resources.
You bring up an interesting point, because there are people who are opposed to wind power because the windmills either are a blight in their view on the landscape, or birds fly into the propellers and are killed by these what do you call them? They're not windmills.
Turbines.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. And your organization wants voters to insist that the candidates in this year's election speak honestly about our nation's energy needs. So, if that were to happen, which is doubtful, what would we hear?
Trying to make it happen, Mike. We're really trying.
What would we hear from Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, from Paul Ryan and Joe Biden? What would we hear in an honest conversation about those needs?
Well, we'd probably hear much of what we hear today, but what we would see that would be different is their actions. And let me tell you why. And let me just use the president as an example. And not to be unkind to the president, he talks about being for all the above. Yet when you look at the actions, he was out in Colorado or someplace yesterday, Iowa, talking about wind energy. Wind energy is very important. Many of the leaders in wind energy come from the oil and gas business. We need to build that as fast as we can. But the president talked about he has doubled wind energy capacity in the United States since he took office. We applaud him for that. That is fantastic, because what it shows is we've got another emerging technology that we're figuring all the tough issues out with, the ones you've mentioned. How to make sure we don't hurt the bird population, the migratory birds, how we make sure we, you know, protect people's view sheds, etc. But what the president doesn't do is he doesn't mention to the public that after doubling wind capacity, it's only about 1% of our energy. So while it's great we've gone from 0.5% to 1%, what about the other 99? We need a conversation that brings in the other 99. Of that 99, 62% of it is oil and natural gas. So when the president says, well, I'm for all the above, but I want to tax the oil and natural gas industry, I've got 12 different departments and agencies in the federal government looking to regulate to discourage the use of hydraulic fracturing, the very technology I just mentioned to you that's opened up these vast energy resources, when he also talks about locking up the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, taking 85% of the Outer Continental Shelf off limits, those actions aren't consistent with the words. What we'd like to see is a truthful, robust debate that says, you know what, let's talk turkey here. Let's talk energy reality. How do we make sure we provide the energy as low cost and as affordable as we can for the American people and do it right here in our own country? And I think what we'd find is a very robust debate around the staple forms of energy, our oil, our natural gas, nuclear as it relates to electricity, coal as it relates to electricity. And then we'd add to that all the new forms. I was struck by the president's comments just a few months ago. Remember when he talked in his State of the Union? He's for all of the above. He wants to look for alternatives and renewables. And then he talked about a grant of $17 million to study algae. Now, that's good stuff, because those are alternative forms of energy. What he didn't talk about is one of our major oil and gas companies had invested $600 million in algae about 3 or 4 years before. So this industry is the leader in looking for those breakthrough technologies, and some of our politicians are the Me Toos that come on behind. We need a robust, candid debate, regardless of political party. This isn't about Republicans and Democrats. Energy should not be a partisan issue. Unfortunately, it's kind of evolved in that way over the years. But it impacts everybody equally. The people it hurts the most are the people who can afford it the least.
I'm curious as to why you think that this debate has not happened, because it's certainly beyond the shadow of a doubt, it's certain that we need this conversation. It's beyond a shadow of a doubt we need a solidified, sensible energy policy in this country. Without energy, this country stops, period. There's no debating that at all. So why hasn't it happened? Because it didn't happen in the Bush administration. It hasn't happened in the Obama administration. It didn't happen in the Clinton administration. It didn't happen in the previous President Bush's administration. And I don't believe it happened in the Ronald Reagan administration. And big oil and big gas They are the biggest industries in the world. They make more profits than anybody in the world. Why, with all their lobbyists and all their money and all their power, have they not been able to make this conversation come to pass?
Well, I think it's more than just the conversation, but let me tell you what we're doing to encourage that conversation. We've got a Vote for Energy campaign that we're running today, and we're doing it across the country, and we're focused in those target states. And why are we focused there? Because that's where the debate and the discussion's occurring. That's where the politicians are going for the votes. That's where they're mining the local constituencies to say, I need these people's help to elect me to public office. So what we have done as an industry is we've gone in with a campaign, and we call it Vote for Energy. And you see it in your good state, and you see it in other good states across this country. And it's designed to take the energy issue, to put it at the utmost and foremost in people's minds, and encourage people to think about that energy equation. Because what that does is these political officials are responsive to the voters. When the voters start rising up in mass numbers and say, wait a minute, let's cut the rhetoric, let's talk about energy realities here, that's when we'll start seeing the change in public policy.
But now you are
from the ground up.
But you are the president of the American Petroleum Institute, and those of us who are consumers and who are affected by your industry only by the air we breathe and the fact that the price goes up at the pump periodically, and we complain about that when it does. But we hear that as these prices go up, it's because of pressures, political pressures around the world and uncertainty, et cetera. And yet at the same time we hear of record profits, astronomical, unbelievable profits at ExxonMobil and others, even as they are complaining about the crippling problems that they face in the world. So how are we to believe your industry? I'm asking this from a point of complete naivete, because I really don't understand this, how an oil company can be under great pressure and make remarkable profits at the same time. So how are, because obviously if we open up these areas that are off limits to your industry, you stand to profit mightily. How are we to trust you?
It's a great question, Mike, and you know what I need to do is I need to go on the Mike Collins Show more often to talk about the reality of these things. And let me give you one quick example. When you made the comment, record profits of big oil companies, etc., let me just pull the curtain back a little bit, dispel the myth. Who owns the oil and natural gas companies? 98.5% of all oil and natural gas shares are held by pension plans, 401k plans, school teachers, firefighters, CalPERS out of California, and the list goes on. So we need to understand it's great political rhetoric and theater for politicians to blame big companies, corporations, these are the bad people. Well, let's think through this for a minute. Who owns those? Go look at your own 401k, your own pension plan, whatever it is. I can almost guarantee you, though I've never looked at your portfolio, Mike, you own the big oil companies. And do you know what? Who benefits from that when they make profits like that? You do. The school teachers, the firefighters, the firemen, and everybody else out there, the police force that are part of these pension plans, they are the ones that own the oil companies. And that's one of the big unfortunate myths that we need to dispel in this company, in this country. Some idea that somehow big is bad. Companies are big because they employ a lot of people. These happen to be Americans that are working hard. They have aspirations in life just like everybody else does. They want to feed their children. They want to take them to school. They want to do all the right things. And what we find is in the oil and natural gas industry, there's opportunity to benefit pension plans, 401ks, individual investment by these people. So we need to get away from that short-term, short-sighted political rhetoric that you hear a lot of politicians talk about. And we need to have a candid conversation. Let me give you one factual case in point that might surprise you. We talk a lot, and we hear the president in particular, and not to be unkind to the president, but he's the one that keeps raising it. He's out there demagoguing, big oil gets subsidies. The oil and natural gas industry gets no subsidies at all. We are the highest effective tax rate payers in this country. But guess who makes the most profit in the United States today? Which company? It's actually Apple Computer. Now, can you imagine what would happen if the president went out tomorrow and said, I'm going to tax Apple Computer because they've got record profits this year. They make more than ExxonMobil makes. And because they're making so much money, we need to get them to pay more. Now, the average consumer would say, wait a minute. I have an Apple. I have the iMac. I've got a computer in my home. That impacts me. Well, the survey work we did just over this weekend points out that over 60% of the American people today understand tax increases on oil and gas companies hurt them, and it hurts them in the pocketbook because it impacts them at the gas pump.
When you say you don't get any, subsidies, I'm curious about this because I know, personally, because I've been approached by an oil concern in Texas to invest. And his point was, if you buy a half share in this drilling operation for, I'm going to quote him now, for $11,000 and we don't pump a drop of oil, you're only going to lose $7,000 given your income and your tax bracket, et cetera, because you're protected by the tax code. You're being incentivized by the government to invest because the downside of your investment is being protected. Isn't that a subsidy?
Well, first of all, if somebody told that to me, I would check them out pretty closely, and I would encourage you to do the same. If you've got somebody out there suggesting with a $10,000 investment you can only lose seven, they've got some racket going on that's better than anything else I've heard. But
no, it's based on your being rewarded by the government for not being taxed.
No. And let me clarify that because
I have 40
this is another
seconds.
One of those.
40
okay.
Seconds.
The oil and gas industry gets zero subsidies. The provisions the president's talking about repeal are standard cost recovery provisions in the tax code that apply to lots of other people. The New York Times gets the very same provisions we get. Apple Computer gets the same because they're designed to recover costs of your investment. That's what the president's talking about. So if the president suggests we're being subsidized, every industry in the United States is being subsidized, and that takes us back to a broader tax discussion. What should the tax code say? And we're all for that discussion.
Okay. We didn't get to talk about the Keystone Pipeline, and we're completely out of time, but I thank you for the hour. Jack Girard, President and CEO of the American Petroleum
Institute. Great to visit with you, Mike, and maybe we'll see you next week when we come down.